From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, coming to you live from Manchester, New Hampshire, in the thick of the nation's first 2012 presidential primary. American elections know their waves. 2010 was a big one. A Tea Party GOP wave hit Congress hard. It rocked a lot of state houses, too. None harder than New Hampshire's, the biggest in the nation swing. Is New Hampshire still swinging Republican? Is the country, or is that over? It's going to matter big this hour on Point. States in motion, swinging politically, New Hampshire and across the country in 2012. You can join the conversation. Did the 2010 GOP Tea Party wave turn your state blue to red, Democrat to Republican? Which way do you see the country turning now? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Rivers of people in New Hampshire flowing to the polls today to vote, especially of all, of course, in the GOP primary. As that happens, we're looking at what's going on in this state and around the country. We've got a great panel with us here live in Manchester on primary day. James Pendle is here, political director at WMUR.com, at WMUR-TV in New Hampshire, where he writes the Political Scoop blog. The Washington Post calls him the insider's insider on New Hampshire politics. James Pendle, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
And with us, Neil Levesque, executive director of the New Hampshire Institute of Politics at St. Anselm College. He's all plugged in. Neil Levesque, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Great to have you.
The great Ron Brownstein joins us today in New Hampshire from the National Journal, author of The Second Civil War, How Extreme Partisanship Has Paralyzed Washington and Polarized America. He's got the big national picture. Ron Brownstein, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I want to hear James explain where all the snow has gone in New Hampshire.
Yeah, what's up? It's supposed to be Arctic up here. They have global warming all over. And our own On Point news analyst, Jack Beatty, is here at our happily crowded table. Welcome, Jack. You're on your
home
turf.
Thank you, Tom.
All right, here we are. James, I'm coming first to you. What happened in 2010 in New Hampshire that made everybody point right there? It happened in many states across the country. But here you had a big swing from what to what?
There's no question about it. This has been a big Republican state, New Hampshire, for much of its history. But demographics caught up. And since 1992, New Hampshire's been a swing state. And then in 2006, Democrats had their most successful election since Reconstruction. That seemed to put to bed the big question in the state. Would New Hampshire finally fall in line with the rest of Democratic New England and become this big Democratic state? Democratic governor, Democratic House and Senate, Democratic members of Congress.
You're talking state House and state Senate.
State Senate
and
state
Executive
House,
Council, which is
executive
very powerful
council,
here.
And the most popular governor in state history, a Democrat. Mm-hmm. But then 2010 happens, and it's the most successful election for Republicans in state history, even with that humongous Republican history that this state has had. And so now we're back to swing state status. You know, 41% of this state are independent voters, technically an undeclared. They haven't picked a party. Then it's 30% Republican and 29% Democrat. This is not only a fascinating political state. Of course, I argue it's the most fascinating. I work here. I'm a little biased. But also, the campaign doesn't stop here today. It goes to the general election.
Now, remind us what happened in that 2010 election. You still got a Democratic governor, but in your state houses, you had you've got a very large legislature for a little state, 400 and something.
We have the largest state legislature in the country.
And you had 100-plus swing there.
100-plus swing. Of course, it's easy to say that we had the most dramatic swing in the country when we have the most seats in the country.
That's half the population.
But a big Tea Party element in there, too. Obviously, we have, it's not half the population. We have one state rep for every 3,200 people, which I believe for the state of California, what is it, 90,000 state reps they'd have?
The Senate also goes, your
but
executive council, 5-0 wipeout. The Democrats lost everything there, Republicans all in. You've still got a moderate Democratic governor, John Lynch, but as the Boston Globe calls him, a speck of blue now in an ocean of red.
And he narrowly won re-election, even though he's the most popular governor in state history. I think it's important when we make fun of how many state reps we have, it's important to note they make $100 a year. It's part of the participatory and empowered electorate up here in New Hampshire.
Hey, have it.
Used to running. We know the issues, and we ask the tough questions of candidates.
Neil, I want to bring that to you, but Jack Beatty, you've got a perch up here in Hanover, New Hampshire. You've been here. You were watching. What did you see happen in 2010 in New Hampshire that may be relevant then and now to the rest of the country?
Well, I asked John Gregg, the veteran political reporter of the Valley News, really one of the best political reporters up here, just that very question. What changed? And he said what changed was the deficit. He said, President Obama.
The state deficit or the national?
The national deficit. Mm-hmm. That President Obama ran on change, and the change that New Hampshire voters saw was red ink. The TARP and the stimulus together creating over $1 trillion in deficit. And that sort of stirred the inveterate fiscal conservatism of even independent voters here and really accounted for the swing against certainly the swing to the Tea Party, that was their big issue, and against President Obama. And he said you could even see this coming before the election when Paul Hodes, who was the Democratic rep in my area, voted against the TARP. He didn't want to get touched. Even in a relatively liberal part of the state, he didn't want any part of that kind of deficit spending. So Greg really thought that deficit really tapped into what Republican and even independent voters.
Now, of course, this journalist, John Gregg, is nephew of Judd Gregg, former Republican senator here. But we sent one of our colleagues out, WBUR's Dan Mousey, on Sunday. He talked with Will Robliski of Dunbarton, New Hampshire. Here he is saying he thinks New Hampshire has gotten redder because, Will said, of overreach by Democrats.
The Democrats have, ruined our state, and people are tired of it. Their spending was out of control. Their regulations, the over-regulations, were out of control. Just the size and scope of government was out of control. And the Republicans were swept into office because people realized, that we can't sustain the budgets that we've had previously. So it's definitely redder.
Definitely redder in New Hampshire. It happened in a lot of states across this country. Of course, we saw it on Capitol Hill. The Congress came in, that freshman class, the Tea Party class that came in, has really affected policy at the national level. The question is now, what's swinging in 2012? Is the country still swinging Republican, still swinging right? Or have we gone Obama, Republican, Tea Party, and now something back? Neil Levesque, how do you describe what happened in New Hampshire and why? Is this just snapping back to historical mold or something else?
Well, if 2010 was about deficits, then 2012 is probably going to be about the economy. Now, the interesting thing here in New Hampshire is that we have a very low unemployment rate of 5.2% compared to the national level. That's almost full unemployment if you're an economist. And but the fact is that the candidate right now, Governor Romney, who has the lead, is giving an economic message, and it seems to be resonating with voters. That's very interesting. There's still a lot of nervousness here in New Hampshire with foreclosures, with people losing their jobs, and certainly a lot of sympathy with the rest of the country. But as we go, I think the variable on this one is going to be time and the candidate that the Republicans put against the president are the two big variables. And if the president gets numbers like he did last week, I'm sure that they were celebrating.
Better employment numbers.
Absolutely.
Not great, but certainly better.
That is going to be the variable that mixes in with time. And
but do you feel the ferment of another swing here? Or is this New Hampshire still shifted to this Republican track, and that's where it stands?
Well,
you've got a mixed
Big factors isn't necessarily ideology. I think that there's a big factor with personality. When you put candidates up, here we have a Democratic governor, as you mentioned, who's very popular. And we had a U.S. Senate candidate, Kelly Ayotte, who is very popular. So the fact is that maybe New Hampshire voters and the rest of the country are looking at who is this person, not necessarily are they of my party.
Let's hear from some listeners. Donna, right across the border in Jericho, no less, Vermont. Donna, thanks for calling. What do you know?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I grew up in Nashua, and as soon as I could, I crossed the border, New Hampshire independents are the biggest flip-floppers on the planet.
New Hampshire independents, independents are supposed to be entitled to go wherever they like.
Well, yeah, but they can't make up their mind. I feel like they're too indecisive. Make up your mind. It's one party or the other. The Republicans have a certain set of ideals, and the Democrats have a certain set of ideals. Either you're one or the other.
And independents are a huge swing factor in this state. What do you say?
Well, I also grew up in Nashua, and I can tell you that, caller, that a lot of people actually are moving up from Massachusetts into the lower sections of New Hampshire, and that is actually having the opposite effect. The strongest areas for Republicans right now are along that Salem, New Hampshire, lower end border. And there's a lot of theories behind why that is that people are sort of escaping
a
different government
former
model.
Is there Republican Massachusetts people heading north to live free or die?
Absolutely. It's certainly a different government model, and it's having an effect. The old-time situations where these old Yankees in small towns that were voting Republican consistently is certainly not the case. if some of us saw the movie White Christmas at Christmas time and the joke in it with Bing Crosby about Vermont and saying that the rarest thing here is a Democrat, I mean, that's certainly the case, too, on the Vermont border of New Hampshire.
Ron Brownstein, we've got a lot of states that were swinging in 2010. What about this year, Romney? Look, state by state, key swing states. What's the motion? What's the dynamic you see, Ron?
Well, I don't think there's an intrinsic, consistent dynamic toward one party or the other, which itself mm-hmm. is a big change from 2010, mm-hmm. when there was a sharp movement toward the Republicans really across the country. They won the most midterm seats in the House since for either party since 1938. One thing that's going to be different, Tom, is the electorate is going to look very different in 2012 than it did in 2010.
Why?
Well, because midterm elections are older and whiter than presidential elections as a general proposition, and 2010 was older and whiter even more than usual. The minority share of the vote dropped off in the midterm, as it usually does. The youth share of the vote dropped off, as it usually does, and actually went even further than is common. So you
see a blue or more Democratic picture in 2012?
Well, the electorate will be more favorable, but that mm-hmm. doesn't necessarily guarantee success, because the Republicans, obviously, we saw an enormous swing. Republicans won the highest share of the white vote that they have won in any congressional election in the history of polling. They won over 60% of white seniors, over 60% of whites without a college education. So if the economy, as was suggested, begins to come back, you could see improvement for the president. But the bigger, I think, hope for the Democrats is that this is going to be a very different electorate, and they have to turn out what has become their base of minorities, young people.
Ron, stand by. We're up against a break here. We're looking at swing states across the country on primary day in New Hampshire. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking today about how New Hampshire went hard from Democratic blue to Republican red and what key states are swinging where around the country in 2012. This big election year, we're looking at the nation's politics in motion live from New Hampshire on the First in the Nation primary day underway right now. People headed to the polls. Our own Jack Beatty is with us here today. James Pindle's here from WMUR-TV in New Hampshire. Neil Levesque is with us from St. Anselm College, and Ron Brownstein with the big national picture from the National Journal. You can join us 800-423-8255. Here's a little bit of former New Hampshire Governor John Sununu, Republican to the bone, telling NPR's Steve Inskeep yesterday about those 2010 elections, marking a return to New Hampshire's conservative historical roots.
We won back the two congressional seats. We held the Senate seat. So this state has gone back to its important results of having Republicans controlling the House, the Senate, the Council. It is a state that has historically has been center-right, conservative. It has, in the past, had Democratic governors. It had a Democratic governor that was very popular, and I think their success, and even their success in the presidential races, were because he was a pretty good leader of their party. But we've got a party now that's united, and New Hampshire will go, if Mitt Romney is the nominee, New Hampshire will go strong Republican in the general election.
Strong for Mitt Romney, says Republican John Sununu. My colleague, Fred Tice, was in Peterborough, New Hampshire, on Tuesday. He asked Sue Martin, a New Hampshire independent, who says she'll vote for Huntsman in the primary and Obama in the general, what she thought about why New Hampshire went red in 2010.
I think they got wrapped up in all that conservative Tea Party and the economy. I think people got scared, and I think they just did what the rest of the country did, which is, let's have a big shift to the right. And I'm sorry it's happened, but let's hope it swings the other way for us.
New Hampshire had the biggest in the nation swing in 2010. We're looking at where states may be swinging in this election. Here we've got all kinds of response online. One listener says, why New Hampshire went blue to red? They tried moon bats for a while, I guess he means liberals, and didn't like what they got, so they returned to sanity. Another listener responds, suppose for a moment that you could take every liberal policy law and individual, make them disappear from the U.S., what kind of nation do you think we would have? Well, we can think about that. We can think about that. Jack, do you see a national trend this year? I mean, do you see, you know, here's Obama looking to hang on to the White House. We've heard a lot about Republicans in recent weeks because of this primary season. It's all ginned up. We know what happened in 2010. That was a big wave that hit Capitol Hill, and not only there. We've got tides running in all directions now, or one, Jack?
Well, you know, Ron's magazine, National Journal, ran a poll a couple of months ago, really, pointing out that President Obama has dropped off on almost every category of voter who supported him. That was it's understandable that he wouldn't have Republican votes, but on independent votes, just collapsing. Young voters, all but African American voters, he had lost support across the board. That's one thing. The second thing is the White House gave a briefing. Maybe Ron was there to reporters about their scenarios for victory, and they laid out, I think, three or four different electoral college maps, and in one of them, they were winning by two electoral votes, you know, and in that case, New Hampshire's four electoral votes looms very large indeed, as does the, you know, I don't know, what does Iowa got, eight? That also looms large. So these small states are really important in such a tight election.
James, do you see a trend in this state, in this year, in New Hampshire? Does it stick GOP? Is it in flux again when we come to the general? Is it obvious what the coloration is going to be?
I agree and I disagree with Governor Sununu, and that's going to probably get me in trouble. But I agree that if Mitt Romney...
Well, he never goes after journalists.
No. We have a great relationship sometimes. No,
he was spanking Chris Matthews over the weekend. That was funny.
He's right that if Mitt Romney is the nominee, he is likely to win this state in the general election. He is wrong that Republicans are united. I don't know, coming out of this Republican primary, what the Republican brand is right now. I think we're in a period of flux, or a period of figuring that out, but they're not united yet.
It's this or that. It's what or what. What are the variables in that fluxy brand?
We're coming out of the Tea Party element, which continues to control our state house. It had for a brief period of time officially controlled the state Republican Party as a chairman. That person resigned under some pressure. And now they're trying to figure out if they're going to pick a more moderate path. They're going to try to figure out the new leaders. I think we've seen Senator Kelly Ayotte, as Neil referred to before, really emerge this year as a new major party leader. And she is not of the Tea Party ilk. She is sort of a part of it, but not completely of it. Mm-hmm. And I think they're trying to figure out the pathway forward. But we like to say, in terms of the swings back and forth in this state, as much as we like to think that we have so many state reps, that all politics is local, the reality is national politics really dramatically impacts the back and forth. So in 2006, we elected Democrats to the State House to end the war in Iraq. We like to joke. Mm-hmm. And then we elected Republicans to the State House in 2010 to fix the federal deficit and end Obamacare, as they like to say.
Driving national policy from the State House in New Hampshire. Neil, here's a listener. John says the premise here is flawed. He says, while predominantly Republican, there's always been a strong Democratic presence in New Hampshire, he's looking at here. We'll look at other states. Most of these, he writes about New Hampshire, are traditional Republicans, Huntsman Republicans, if you will. Now, this is John's view. He says the Dems in the state are Clinton Democrats, meaning they're on the conservative end of the spectrum, generally not liberal. Maybe there's not as big a swing here as the numbers suggest.
Well, this state was definitely a solid Republican state. In 1958, basically, Ted Sorensen came up here and had to put together his own organization getting ready for the 60 Kennedy race because the Democrats were so subservient in the establishment, so subservient to the Republicans who were in command. The fact is that in that Ayotte primary, the U.S. Senate primary, there was a very divisive and hard-fought fight, but the Republicans came together in the end. I think the interesting thing today with the primary is going to be our Secretary of State is a good predictor. He thinks that 75,000 people will vote on the Democratic ballot today.
That's because there's also that primary going.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
So
pro forma,
if you're a supporter of the president, you're going to drive down to your little town hall and you're going to vote for him, even though there's not really a contest. And if we're really low below that 75,000 number, that's going to show how motivated some of these folks are.
Jack, here's a comment online from a listener who says, so they swept Republicans into office because they blamed Democrats for implementing programs started by the Republicans. Deficit spending to fight the Great Recession, TARP, bailouts, you might add war there. Is there a nuance coming in? The emotions have been driving people all over the place. The crash, the war drove people. The crash drove people. Yes. The bailouts after the crash drove people. I mean, maybe there's not one big wind blowing now. People are kind of making more nuanced judgments.
And it may be that will leave a cross-pressured electorate here and a very close election. But if you look at the president's ratings here, 31% approved of his performance in October.
Who,
this is President
Obama.
This is in this state.
41.
I had 31 in
October. UNH was 41.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And, well, and in October, I have 67% of undeclared voters disapproving of his performance. I mean, that's a steep. I don't know. There may be other states where it's as bad. I can't imagine there's any state north of the Mason-Dixon line.
And the state that voted for President Obama.
The state that voted
with
for
54%
right.
of the vote in 2008.
Ron Brownstein, give us, again, a national view here. I know it breaks down into many states, but we've seen the president's approval numbers, and they have not been good. How does that augur for flipping states in his direction? I mean, he's got key states he's really going to need this time and some that he hasn't had before.
I think if you look at everything, we are pointing back toward the 50-50 nation that we talked about in the early part of the 21st century when the country was almost evenly divided. I think it is likely that the presidential election will be decided by a narrower margin both in the popular vote and the Electoral College than it was last time either way, that the margin in the House will be narrower than it is today, and that the margin in the Senate could well be narrower than it is today. I mean, you've got two big overriding factors here that I think are kind of shaping the inability of either party to establish a lasting advantage. Because let's look at what we're talking about here. From 2004 to 2006, the country fired the Republicans. They reaffirmed that judgment in 2008 when Obama won the most decisive victory for any Democrat since Johnson in 64. And then 2 years later, only 2 years later, you know, the sharp snapback toward the Republicans. Neither party today, I believe, has a stable ideological majority, a majority of the country that accepts its ideological vision of the role of government in society. There is not a Reaganite majority, and there is certainly not a Democratic activist majority. The last roughly 25% of the electorate is neutral on that kind of fundamental dividing line, or at least not consistent, and they vote based on performance. And the reality is that neither party has been able to deliver the performance in terms of economic security that would allow them to kind of create a lasting hold on voters. So I think that this is going to be a close election again, and I think for whichever side wins in 2012, the best three words of advice will be, don't unpack everything, because there is no sign. I was watching Rick Santorum last night say, this is the most important election in our lifetime. This is probably the most important election until 2014. It doesn't feel as though we are anywhere near either party being able to establish a lasting advantage. As a result, I think, you know, because you've got a closely balanced country, the last portion of the electorate is not ideologically wedded to each party, and they are increasingly dissatisfied with both. And that's a recipe for volatility.
We've got to get our listeners in here. James Pindle with WMUR-TV in New Hampshire. You're great, and I want to thank you for being with us today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We're live in New Hampshire on primary day. James Pindle, thanks for joining us. Jack, Neil, Ron, stand by. Let's go to, by the way, Santorum. I was there last night. I heard him say, you know, if Obama wins this election, the country we love is gone. It is gone. And that little knot of supporters, whatever, what was it, 50, 100, I don't know. They loved it, but where is the whole country? Mark in Paulett, Vermont. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much for taking my call. I'm thrilled to be on the show.
Great to have you.
Thanks. I have an observation. Watching the Republican primaries, listening to the Republicans, they have a very strong identity toward conservatism. They embrace it. They use it in every sentence they possibly can, it seems.
Yeah.
And the Democrats, on the other hand, seem to take liberalism and hide from it. They not alone not embrace it, but seem to run from the term. And in a two-party system, isn't it one side is conservative and the other side is liberal? And I really feel that the Democrats have a real identity crisis when they run from the moniker that's supposed to be theirs.
That is so interesting, Mark. Let us pick that up. I mean, Ron, how do you read that? You know, conservative Republicans, they sort of tattoo it right on their foreheads.
No,
Democrats stash it in their backpack, the liberalism. Why? What's up with that?
There's no question that is absolutely right. Well, the short answer, and maybe this you'll say chicken and egg, but twice as many Americans identify as conservatives than liberals, you know, about 40%.
So it's just endemic. It's just the way we are.
You know, many more voters identify as conservatives than liberals, although moderates traditionally have been slightly more than conservatives. I believe in the last couple of years it's moved back the other way. So you might have something like low 20% of the electorate conservatives both liberal, high 30s both moderate and conservative. And now you can say, well, if Democrats use the word liberal more often, maybe more people would identify as liberals. But the fact is that Democrats are not generally comfortable with that phrase. They try to identify themselves as progressives or pragmatists and, you know, use different language there. You know, having said that, the whatever you call it, the differences between the parties on the role of government are really stark at this point in our history, in particular because the Republicans have moved towards such a small government, anti-spending, anti-tax, anti-regulation agenda. Whoever wins, I think, is going to be running on the most determined, ambitious efforts to retrench government of any Republican nominee since at least Reagan in 1980, if not Goldwater in 64.
50-50 nation, maybe. Split down the middle, maybe. But what a canyon between, Jack.
Yes, you know, one of the best, and I think still resonant, observations about the electorate was by Samuel Lubell in a book in the 50s. He said the American electorate is ideologically conservative but programmatically liberal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the case of the woman saying, Lee, keep your hands off my Medicare.
My Social Security, my Medicare.
Yes, mm-hmm. And Democrats and liberals have simply not been able to say to the electorate, look, you like all these things, and the things you like, and if you started to add them up, add up to being a liberal. That hasn't happened. That persuasion hasn't even been exercised. But there's always that hope, I think, among Democrats that they can just point to all the things separately people like, aggregate them and say, ha-ha, voila.
Well, the mixed economy that we rode in the 20th century to great effect.
That's right.
It's hard to line up with one true religion. Beth in Bedford, New Hampshire. Beth, you're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. My comment was earlier you had someone call in and they said in 2010 New Hampshire moved to a red state because they thought that the Democrats had overstepped their boundaries.
Yeah.
And I think what we've been seeing is we went to a truly red legislature here in New Hampshire, and they've been really overstepping their boundaries as far as gun rights, and particularly in health care and mental health care. And I think people are going to see that, and they're going to go the other way come November. And I think it will, hopefully that will also lead us in the other way on the presidential candidate as well. But we also see, people know we need schools, we need teachers, and maybe we'll see it go the other way this fall.
That's interesting. Beth, let me put it to Neil Levesque right here. Neil, I mean, do you see overreach? The argument was it went the other way. Gay rights were put on the – gay marriage even on the agenda in New Hampshire when the Democrats were there. Now, pushing back on gun rights, on mental health spending, Beth indicates, have the policies that your big red swing brought to your state house left the Republicans in good order here, or is there a kind of a pushback underway?
Well, it seems that almost in every election, there's always pushback right after they start passing the bills that they promised to do. And I think the best example of this is Barack Obama. He runs for president. He makes 14 speeches a day basically saying he wants a certain type of health care program.
Yeah.
And then he goes 3 months later and tries to pass it. And people say, well, wait a second.
What are you doing?
He didn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
How come he didn't tell us he was going to do that? Well, the fact is he did. And so, going into this election, the key, I think, David Axelrod, when he came to St. Anselm College, he might have been correct when he said that this is going to be a titanic effort, this re-election campaign. But I would not underestimate
to make it successful.
Correct.
You mean. Mm-hmm.
And the president, he's got the bully pulpit. He can fly into a state, make a speech, and it's all over the place. You can see it. It gets a clear message to voters, and I would definitely not underestimate that team.
That team, and with states in motion all over the place, Jack, the country is sitting here looking at its political navel for a minute, but there's a lot going on in that navel. I mean, we're still in Afghanistan. Huh. We're just out of Iraq, and it's in trouble. We got Iran. You come back home. The economy in trouble 6 ways to Sunday. We've got the deficit and issues to figure out. It is tempting then to go to one hard political view of this, but maybe the country's not that cleanly lined up.
I think Ron puts it well. It's a 50-50 country. And Tom, you were talking about going to a Santorum rally and seeing the audience respond to his, if we have 4 more years of Obama, it'll be a different country. I've seen the same thing at Mitt Romney. He uses that very line. Mm-hmm. Republicans genuinely see Obama not just as another Democrat, but as a deep threat to what they see as Americanism, as the essence of the American system. The stakes are pretty high for them.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about how New Hampshire went hard from Democratic blue to Republican red and what key states are swinging where around the country in 2012. We are in New Hampshire on the first in the nation primary day today, looking at the nation's politics very much once again in motion. Ron Brownstein is with us from the National Journal, author of The Second Civil War, and that is about American politics. Neil Levesque is with us from St. Anselm College. Our own Jack Beattie is here. My colleague Fred Tice was out in Peterborough, New Hampshire this week talking with George Curzon, who said he's a Republican, but he thought the pendulum had swung too far to the right in his state in the last election, and here he is.
Well, that was a reaction to, it was like the same as the Tea Party. You know, it was a reaction to what was going on in Congress. However, the Republicans in this state have gone a little bit extreme. You know, they've gone overboard. That's why you need to have a two-party system. People get crazy when they get power. So, although I'm a Republican, I welcome the Democratic Party. I'm glad it's there.
A little view there, maybe a preview, review. People get a little crazy when they get power. Rob in Nashua, New Hampshire. Thanks for calling, Rob. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah. I was calling more in response to one of the previous callers who talked about New Hampshire being a bunch of flip-floppers. I don't think the issue is with people flip-flopping. I think it's with the party system itself. I think people, you know, they try to stick to party lines and instead of getting their own individual voice. And I think if they didn't, try to stick to party lines, they might have a more unique voice that people could identify with rather than, you know, trying to stay within the lines.
But isn't that how you build a kind of push of power in this country? You band together in a party, you rally around a flag, and you raise it.
Well, yes, that is true. But I think that's part of the problem is that they think they need to stick together to get into power. And yes, that is the way it is working now. But it's restricting things. It's restricting ideas.
Restricting ideas. Ron Brownstein, I mean, that sounds a little bit like a version of Obama in the last big presidential election. You know, let's break out of these straitjackets of ideology and sit together and speak with one another and work it out. Now, we saw how that worked, Ron, as in
right.
It didn't work.
No, it's very hard in the modern system. Almost everything in contemporary politics works to widen rather than narrow differences. Each party's voting base is more ideologically homogenous than it used to be, especially on the Republican side. You have overtly partisan media of left and right that is very quick to punish anyone who is seen as compromising too much. We had as many successful primary challenges in 2010 against sitting senators as we had in the previous 28 years. You have the congressional leadership in each party is more willing to use tools and punishment and levers like denying, overturning a chairman despite seniority to encourage party line voting. And then you have well-funded interest groups of left and right from Move On, but again, especially on the right, like Club for Growth, that are willing to put money into disciplining people. So almost everything we see pushes the parties apart. But as that caller suggests, there really is no evidence that the American public likes this kind of politics. The level of party line voting in Congress is the highest it's been since the 19th century. Sure, parties have stuck together to band together to advance their point of view, but they have generally, through American history, A, contained more diversity within them, and B, kind of understood that they don't have the last word, and there is some kind of give and take that is often more common. So I think the kind of the absolutist all-or-nothing politics that we have does also leave a lot of voters cold and contributes to the volatility. And it's exactly right. The national level, look at the backlash that House Republicans face. A year after this historic victory, you're looking at a 9% approval rating. That's like immediate friends and family. So there's something to that call, but our political system is not organized in a way right now to respond to it.
9% congressional approval, Ma, Pa, and the kids still love us, everybody. Yeah. Ron, bounce us across the national map for a minute, if you would.
Yes.
We're sitting in New Hampshire where they had a big swing to the Republican side of the ledger last time out. Nationally, what states are you following with greatest interest that may be in motion, either to the left or right here this time out?
Here's what's fascinating. There are now two parallel sets of swing states that will likely decide this election. Historically, we think of the big swing states as being the Rust Belt behemoths, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Ohio, Wisconsin, Iowa to some extent, Minnesota. Those are predominantly white, older states that are generally not growing in population, and they will be important, in particular, Michigan and Pennsylvania. Obama has to hold them. They're part of that group of 18 states that Democrats have won in at least the past five elections. But, there's now emerging a new set of swing swing states that reflect the changing nature of the Democratic coalition. And these are states that are younger, more diverse, better educated. And there's really two groups of them, a Southeast Conference and a Southwest Conference. Virginia, okay. North Carolina, and Florida in the Southeast, Colorado, Nevada, and New Mexico in the Southwest. They're very different places. They're defined more by growth, as I said, and especially by growing diversity. And Obama, you know, in the past, most of those states have been nice to have for Democrats. They may be must, many of them may be must to have for him, because the, as I said, the older and working class white population has been moving away from Democrats for years, accelerating under Obama, and he is probably going to have to win state to win re-election. He's going to have to win states that look like him, that are diverse and well-educated and are shaped by the same social forces that I think he embodies.
What state or states is he going to have to win this time out that perhaps he didn't last time to make it work, given the 2010 sits in between then and now and all of its Tea Party tide?
Well, I don't think there's any state. I don't think he has to add any state, and I think it's unlikely that he will add any state. But you don't forget, he won 365 electoral college votes. He's got some to give. I think the tipping point states are going to be places like Virginia, North Carolina, Florida, and maybe Ohio. But I think that the tipping point is shifting away from those older Midwestern states toward these growing, younger, diverse Sun Belt states. And if I had to pick one state that is most likely to vote with the winner this year, say whoever won that state is most likely to win, I'd pick Virginia this time.
Neil, look out from New Hampshire. If it's going to go toward a younger electorate making the decision about the swing, what does New Hampshire's experience tell you here? Younger, last time went in 08, very strong to Obama. What about this time out?
Well, the president just opened up 8 offices here in New Hampshire, so they are competing here in New Hampshire. And the youth vote certainly was big last time, but now I think there's an interesting phenomena with Dr. Paul. Dr. Paul has got a very strong contingent of young voters, and when you poll them, they say, well, we don't even know if he can win, but we're still for him. There's two interesting variables we haven't mentioned, and that is, what if a big Bloomberg-type independent gets into this race? What if Dr. Paul gets in as an independent and starts stripping away some of this base? That could be the other big factor going into November.
Let's get a call from Cape Girardeau, Missouri. Jason is on the line. Hi, Jason. Thanks. You're on the air.
Thank you, sir. Yeah, I just wanted to give an opinion on, you know, I've heard people say that the Republican Party is kind of in turmoil and not in, you know, all in line with one candidate. Mm-hmm. And I think that's partially true right about now because of the primary and there's so many different options.
Sure.
But I believe that when it's all said and done, that it's not going to matter. I truly believe that it's not going to matter who gets the nomination, that Obama is very vulnerable in many ways. And I think that the only candidate that he should easily beat would be Ron Paul because of his foreign policy you know, points and stuff like that. But I think the fact that Obama, you know, he pushed the health care, the country for the most part was against that and the way he went about it and the massive spending. And I think when it's all said and done and getting into the general election, the right candidate is going to be able to expose a lot of those things. And I think that people are kind of getting a little too far ahead of themselves saying that the Republican Party is not united and stuff, because that's partially right. But I think even if Romney gets it or Gingrich or whoever, the others will follow suit and support him, you know, just to get Obama out of there.
You're feeling a big head of GOP's team there in Cape Girardeau. We've got that, Jason. Ron, is that justified? How do you assess the president's vulnerability sitting in the White House today? Here we are, first primary of the season. Iowa had its caucuses, but here we go. How vulnerable is President Obama right now?
Well, I would say, he is certainly vulnerable. I mean, he is not Jimmy Carter. He's not George H.W. Bush. The bottom has not fallen out for him. In some ways, his approval rating is higher than you would expect. The political scientists, I think, would agree, given the underlying measures of right track, wrong track, and consumer confidence. So he is hanging around. He is in the game. And if he gets a steady economic uplift through 2012, he would probably become slightly more than a 50% favorite. But I think right now I think most people would put him slightly below or right at 50-50, especially against Romney. Because Romney, obviously there are going to be questions that Romney is going to have to defend his record at Bain Capital. He has not shown, by the way, the capacity really to do that effectively yet. But Romney is, I think, an inherently persuasive candidate for a lot of upper-middle-class white voters. numbers. They don't see him as a social extremist. They like his business background. And I think those are the key swing voters in this election. I think the lower middle class, white working class is going to be very tough for Obama, no matter who the Republican nominee is. And if he has a chance to get rescued in this, he's probably more likely to be rescued upscale than downscale, in part because they're going to feel better about the economy by the end of the year. Romney, I think, is very well targeted to that. So if it's Romney and, say, Marco Rubio, it's hard to believe there will be a moment where Chicago will be breathing entirely easily in this campaign. Although, as I say, the balance could, his position could improve, certainly, if the economy continues to grow, as we saw it in this past jobs report.
Jack Beatty, dig in here for a minute with us, if you would, on Ron Paul. I mean, those voters, everywhere you go, they are there, they are committed, they are young. Yes. Young voters helped in a huge way to put Barack Obama in last time. So, you know, here you've got our caller in Missouri saying, well, Ron Paul's the only one who couldn't win. Nevertheless, he's very likely to come in second, strongly, in New Hampshire here today, had a very good showing in Iowa. What happens with this? Is it an island of voters? If it's an island, it's not a small one. When you get to the general election, do they go Democrat, Democratic Party, Republican Party, Obama, somebody? What happens with the energy? What's the thinking? What's the flow inside that? It's the kind of interesting thing that's in the 50-50 nation, and this is a Grand Canyon in between. Ron Paul's kind of levitating somewhere out there in the middle.
Yes.
But not in a moderate, you know, mushy way.
No. And you know, the anti-war and anti-intervention strophe of his candidacy, I don't think can be underestimated. I don't know what the polls say lately. But the election here in 2006 was all about the Iraq War, really. That's what gave the swing to the Democrats here.
Mm-hmm.
And the fatigue with the interventions, mm-hmm. with the whole foreign policy. I mean, you can see it not just with young people, but with people who voted for President Obama. Again and again at these rallies, for Ron Paul, people say, well, I voted for Obama the last time, but we're in Afghanistan.
But who would have thought that fatigue would have come to roost on a putative Republican?
Yes, yes.
I mean, Ron Paul, he's GOP.
He is GOP, but his foreign policy is GOP 1939. That's the
no war,
the
thank
audit.
You.
Yes. No war, thank you. But I'm just struck with how when he gives those lines, even at Republican debates, you see people who don't look like the usual Ron Paul voter applauding.
Mm-hmm. Enough of that. Enough of those trillions out the door and into a blood-filled trench.
Yes.
David in Franklin, Massachusetts. David, you're on the air.
Yeah, I wanted to bring some attention to something that Jack said a little bit ago when he was quoting Rick Santorum as saying that, you know, Santorum saying that if Obama wins, the country that we love will be gone forever.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is dangerous talk. And I mean the kind of dangerous talk that ends up getting people killed. Similar to the crosshairs over the Gabby Giffords, mm-hmm. on the electoral map. When you start telling people that the country that they love is going to be gone forever, and if Obama does happen to win, I think that there are people on the fringe extreme that will set off. And I think that, you know, the difference for me is, and I'm a strong Obama supporter, and I'm a Democrat, and the difference for me that I see is the strong Democratic impulse is to argue against policy, and the strong impulse from the right is to call us un-American. So if I disagree with your policy, I'm not enough of an American. So Obama's not born in America. He's a stranger. He's the other.
David, I'm going to bring that straight up. We'll bring it strongly up. I promise you. I was there with Santorum last night, and the language is very fierce. And the same thought crossed my mind. Boy, oh boy, the country you love will be gone. That calls out and calls for almost any kind of response. But let me hold up for 1 second. One more call. Concord, Massachusetts. Shot heard around the world. Wayne, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom, and hi, guests. And, you know, your previous caller hits on a point that I would reinforce. You know, as I plan for a winter vacation, I'm disinclined because I consider myself a liberal Democrat. I'm just not inclined to go to a nice warm place like New Orleans or Charleston, South Carolina, because, you know, folks there are going to, you know, they think of me as a socialist and want to take back the country from me. And as a Vietnam-era veteran, you know, I'm thinking, you're going to take back the country from me? You know, who do you think you are with that kind of rhetoric? And it disturbs me. I think your guest, you know, talking about a second civil war and this dichotomy of red and blue states, I think is definitely correct. And I don't like the trends that I see emerging. And that kind of rhetoric from Santorum, I think your previous caller is right.
Civil War drum roll you're hearing in there somewhere. Wayne, I appreciate your call. Our time is short. I apologize. But Neil, to each of these callers and the kind of extremity of emotion that can get wrapped up in these big swings.
There is certainly a lot of visceral language out there. And the fact is that we have spent in here in New Hampshire more time with probably all the candidates. And they're all very patriotic people. They all believe they have a better way to do the job. And it's sad that there's so much hatred sometimes in politics, because they're all wonderful people and they're great to be around, and that's the great thing about the state of New Hampshire.
Ron Brownstein, vote for me or the country you love is gone.
Yeah.
Is that every 4 years we're going to hear that, or is that something unique to our times?
No, I think we're going to hear it for quite a while, but there is not even, we're talking about asymmetrical polarization. The depth of alienation in the most conservative vanguard of the Republican Party, I think, is far beyond anything we're seeing on the left today. Maybe the reverse of the 1960s, but there's no question, I think, that the most alienated corner of American society are portions of the white community that aren't easy with the economy, racial change, and just the overall trajectory of Washington's role in our lives, and they are feeling furious, and Rick Santorum is speaking to that, and you really don't know where it entirely leads.
Watch the color, watch the emotional thermometer. It can really get to be something, and state by state we can see some big swings. We'll be watching this year. Ron Brownstein with the National Journal, you're terrific. Thanks for being with us today live in New Hampshire, Ron.
Thank you.
Neil Levesque with St. Anselm College, Executive Director of the New Hampshire Institute of Politics there. Neil, so great to have you with us.
Thank you.
Jack Beatty, you're out across the Granite State today watching everything going on, democracy in action. Jack.
Yes, that's our model up here.
Here we are in the thick of it. Hey, live free or die, Jack.
I'm going to practice.
Well, just live free. We don't want you to go anywhere. Listeners, thanks for joining us live from Manchester, New Hampshire. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.